Okay, good afternoon. It's 26th of October, the 17th lecture, the second of our use case and requirements lectures. I'm going to be talking today about use cases as a way to take your already systematized requirements and put them into even more systematic form to make them easy to communicate with your shareholders and stakeholders. We'll talk about different kinds of use cases. Particularly, I'll be making a point about essential use cases, which is an up-and-coming buzzword that's being pushed a lot to focus attention on writing use cases in ways which are not but don't assume any kind of technological implementation. We'll talk about setting priorities using the Moscow method. And then we'll talk a bit about Ravenflow, which I'm going to do a 3-minute demo of from their website, because we're going to be using this tool in an upcoming assignment. How many of you have written use cases? How many of you have never written a use case? Oh, good. You're going to get to do it for your team, probably. I'm sure that's what will happen. That's the right way to do it. Okay. Use cases are intended to be a standard way to communicate functional requirements. Now, that's not all the requirements that matter to you in your projects, but it's pretty hard to write a use case about the more qualitative, ility-type requirements because they aren't often easily mapped to functionality. The idea of a use case is sort of an outside-in or black box description of functionality, and it has the perspective of an actor. An actor is often a person, but not entirely a person. It can be a computational actor, or it could even be the system, although we tend to take a point of view in which we design things and we characterize our requirements in the perspective of a human actor with respect to the computational actors who provide services or information for the benefit of the human actors. Although, again, that's completely arbitrary, as you are well aware of by now. The full set of use cases for a system is essentially the definition of its scope. If you haven't written the use case, you're not going to build it. That's pretty obvious. And furthermore, we often organize use cases to emphasize different ways of looking at the functionality of a system. The most common ways are to organize use cases by the actors involved. So you can say, what functionality is the teacher going to be involved with, or the physician going to be involved with, or the schedule going to be involved with? Or we can organize it in terms of, say, the context that we're building for. Maybe that's more of a functional kind of cluster of use cases. Or we might even organize it on the basis of who's going to be responsible. So you could say we're going to partition the set of functionality of the system into different sets so that different teams or individuals could have the responsibility for that subset of functionality. Again, many of you have done use cases. You may have seen pictures like this. This is not a use case. This is a diagram of a use case, and it's not the same thing. Not the same thing because the diagram by itself is not sufficient to know what to build. It's just a little picture. Too often people like to draw pictures, and they don't have to do the hard work, which is to write the scenario, which is the detailed and completely precise specification of the interactions between the actors. That's what's important. You're given this, you don't know what to build. And I spent lots of time with engineers saying, here's my use case. I said, no, these are pictures of use cases. They're not use cases. And so it's important to have a complete view because this diagram, again, is insufficient for reasons that are pretty obvious. But nonetheless, when people say use case, they often mean this. And that's not a use case. That's a use case diagram. You view it as a part of the use case, or maybe the pictorial index to the more complete specification. What is a use case? A use case is a textual description of some set of interactions written in a very stereotyped, some would say boring, mechanical-sounding way, and those are features, not bugs. Right? Because the more you write a use case in a way which sounds boring and repetitive, it means you, in fact, captured the fact that there are going to be repeated actors in use case. And that's what it means to have some set of functionality. Everything that the particular actor is going to do in some particular function area ought to sound repetitive with respect to that actor's name, for example. So here you see a conventional way of writing a use case as a set of steps with a label on that set of steps. In fact, it would probably be more accurate or more conventional to, in fact, have this thing called something like help desk employee logs customer ticket, because that would be more complete representation of who the actors are in the use case. And furthermore, you see an underlined finds customer in the first line of the scenario. That is essentially a subroutine or a subfunction of the use case, which is being called by the kind of main use case here. And the diagram shows that the two actors in this use case are the customer and the help desk employee, who interact for the purpose of creating logging a help desk ticket. And the little arrow here at the bottom of the includes diagram is showing that the find customers use case is needed in this scenario at the beginning, so that when the customer says, "Hi, I got a problem," they have to find that customer in some other resource in order to have some authoritative description of the customer's report. So again, that's what use cases look like. Well, why do we care about this stuff? Why is it important to have use cases? You're going to be writing requirements as a way to synthesize all the work you've done in competitive analysis and technology analysis and ethnography, all things you've done to kind of ideate, a word I despise, which is why I'm saying it over because they make it feel aversive, to ideate or get this set of possible requirements for your design. When you try to systematize that to a more prioritized and sort of doable within scope set, you have to write use cases or something like use cases. Why do you want use cases? Yeah?
I would say it's more like a divide and conquer approach. You think about what's your goal, the more steps you need, and you can define every step and you can divide the work.
It's a really important way to divide the task of building some complex set of functionality into pieces which are more manageable. And that act in itself is a major part of the design. Karen?
Well, when you're writing the requirements, you're not necessarily just thinking about the user. It's not like a lot of the use cases are really helping you to think about the user and what the user needs to have a successful
trade. Okay, again, you use user as the focus. User doesn't have to be the only focus of use case. There can be many actors in use cases, but it is useful to have a way to say, let me identify my primary actors and then be able to say, what are all the things that this actor participates in? It's kind of you're building a kind of database of functions that you can then look at from different ways. And because you have a consistent specification of that function in the use case meta model, which we'll show in a minute, what are the parts of a use case, you have this ability to organize them or partition them in different ways. And again, it's a simplistic notation. When you first look at use cases, you're going, this seems really dumb. So you're dumbing down my whole problem. It looks like this very repetitive way of looking at it with little pictures. And yet, it is essentially, we've seen over time that it's helpful to have a kind of conventional and simplistic representation of the specification because it makes it easy to communicate. And there are lots of conventional wisdom about writing requirements. I don't agree with all of it, but some of it is, for example, that you should never use anything which looks like a programming language flow of control construct in anything you show to a manager. All right? Or an unwashed customer user, because people who are not programmers or computationally oriented can't understand things like iteration or transfer of control. Now, I think that's not true. Nonetheless, that's conventional wisdom, and if you follow that, you're going to have easier to understand requirements than if you just write as if you're writing procedural programming code. So again, the part of what I found myself getting over this when I first got into use cases was this sense of, this is too stupid. It's beneath me to write use cases, and yet when you show customers, it's often very helpful to have it in the format that they can actually understand. Yeah?
Use cases are also helpful in helping you flesh out the entire flow of an operation. Branches, what if this happens, but if this happens, but if this, then this happens, but not this, it actually forces you to look down every contingency.
Absolutely. Again, anything which requires you to be precise and complete and consistent is a good thing, right? Now the question is whether the use case is actually doing that, or is simply capturing the results of that. Is something. What's causing you to get to that point? And as you'll see when we get to Ravenflow, I mean, it's the real work is being precise, and the use case is just a notation that captures that. But and if you like to think in terms of the use case, maybe drawing the use case, that may be where you're doing your thinking in front of it. You had a comment? What are you catching, bugs? Flies? Did you catch it? Okay. All right. So again, the question is, why not just the text specification? If we say the goal is to be precise, well, the reason why you can't use text is because text isn't precise. I mean, we've all written descriptions that we thought were precise or complete or consistent, and yet people read them and go, I'm not sure what to do here. And that's why, as I talked a bit last time when I showed you the examples of simplified writing, which again we'll see more of today, it will sound really almost slightly unintelligent to write in this very simple language, as if you're talking to someone who's of low intelligence with, you know, simple constructs and so on. But it really does help ensure that you have these properties of completeness and consistency and so on, because you can then use that as you can verify that much easier than if you have a more complex structure of your use cases. All right, so the parts of a use case. Again, most people think that the use case is the diagram. That's really just one of three parts. You have the scenario, which is the text description of the interaction going on among the actors. You have properties, or the metadata for the use case, which is often useful, especially in large projects that can have the kind of management of tracking of use cases, the assignment of use cases to different parts of the organization or designers. Those are sometimes called templates, and we'll talk a bit about some templates that I recommend for them. But the meat is the scenario. The scenario is where getting it right really matters, because again, I think that the diagram is just the depiction of the scenario, a transcription. And as you'll see in Ravenflow, again, you write the scenario right, you push a button and you generate the diagrams. So we're trying to eliminate what I think is the inefficient or sort of make work part of the process, which is to draw diagrams. The real effort here is to get a specification right. Again, the part of the lore of use cases is that you want to write what are called happy cases. Again, I just don't understand. There's a lot of kind of silly vocabulary in use case land. One of them is this idea of the happy scenario. I like it to call it success scenario, but they typically call happy scenario for some of the happy case. Meaning, you write a description of the interaction, assuming that it's going to work. When things work as you want them to, what is the sequence of interactions among the actors? And again, it describes some unit of functionality. And again, that's going to be a key question is what is a unit? Because anytime you're describing any kind of process, you have raise levels of abstraction problems. What level of abstraction are you trying to describe? Are we having, what's going on here? Are we saying, we are learning about design, or are we learning about use cases? Are we learning about scenarios within use cases? There's different level of description of what's going on at this very moment right now. And being consistent about that level of description will be a major part of the challenge in writing a good set of use cases. So the idea is that you have some interactions that you're documenting which connect the goals of some participant in the system, in the service system. And again, goals meaning I want to achieve some unit of functionality, I want to carry it out, and I want to have the people who have the capabilities or responsibility to do that to be interacting. So again, part of what use cases is doing is force you to be clear about where you think results are coming from. So again, like this you have a value chain analysis. What part of the system is going to be producing this value? That's what I want to be documenting now. You want to essentially have it be viewed as a snapshot in time, where you capture some relatively small set of interactions that take place in some relatively small period of time where there's no significant time gaps in which other things could happen, most of which would probably be bad. Because you want to be modeling interactions between actors as if they're entirely independent from all other use cases, but in fact they're clearly not. There'll be sets of them which come together, so if you have big time gaps, that'll make this sort of synchronization across use cases be more difficult. And again, as I already said, there's the conventional wisdom that says, don't write programming language constructs, computational flow control constructs in use cases, have a kind of degenerate form of iteration with like go-to instructions to simplify the flow of control from the perspective of the actors. I disagree with that, but I want to tell you what conventional wisdom is. So let me show you an example of that. Again, this would probably be more, to be consistent with the rest of my lecture, it should have been called car driver buys parking ticket, because that would have it be more explicit about who the actor is. These are pulled out of one of the papers, and I suppose they weren't as consistent as I would have liked them to be. I should have edited the car driver in there. But again, here you see this kind of dull, mechanical sounding set of interactions. Car driver puts a coin in the ticket machine. Ticket machine gives you an indication of how much time you've just bought. You keep doing that, you know, step one and two, until you have enough money in the machine. You push the button, generate the ticket, machine prints the ticket. And again, there's this dull repetition by design, because you want to make sure that you're not assuming some other actor in there. If you said the car driver does this, then the person parking the car does this, well, maybe that's the same person, but maybe it isn't. And you want to essentially be as explicit as possible in specifying who the actors are. So again, this word actor is a very key word in use cases, because actors are not just people. Actors could be any purposeful agent who's trying to carry out some act to obtain some results. It could be a person, it could be a role, where the same person may have a number of different roles at different moments and times or in different use cases. And you can view the actor as whatever agent or process is initiating or triggering something to take place. So there's a kind of event that you're really saying. This is the beginning of some event, of some interaction. And that's why it lends itself to this kind of stereotypical description, where you have, person does something to something, or to get something, right? So you have a kind of, think of it as a message. The person is initiating some activity or some function by making a request, making some invocation, making some kind of information exchange with some other actor or system. And that gives you this idea of like actor, verb, noun. Customer places order. Customer cancels order. Customer buys parking ticket, kind of thing. Okay? And you want to avoid abstract verbs which don't give you a lot of semantics. I mean, words like do, process, get, cause are not very useful, because they don't give you very many clues that let you glue together use cases. So picture I like is, again, it reinforces this idea of the parts of the interaction. There is something which is initiating the source, the noun, the user, the actor, who does something that may be, the verb of this interaction template, to some other actor with a target in mind. The target may be the system. All right. So again, I'm by having the same stereotypical way of documenting the use case, I can more readily see which ones have common actors or common targets and so on. Again, this is really straightforward. I want to get through this quickly so I can show you some real examples for previous projects, and show you what I'd like to have you do next week as you're getting one more level of refinement in your designs of your service systems. Again, the conventional wisdom is write things in simple language, active, declarative sentences, as though it works. That means you avoid the sort of deleted agent passive construction, the one that essentially hides the actor. So instead of saying the car driver purchases the parking ticket, you would the wrong way to do it would be to say the parking ticket is obtained, because that doesn't contain the description of who the actor is or the initiator. That's the classic way to avoid responsibility. You say, well, you know, the system, you know, the machine failed. Well, you know, why did the machine fail, right? The operator caused the machine to fail, okay, kind of thing. Okay, there's a notion of how, again, the repeated actor is going to be important in continuity, because you can sort of see how the same actor will appear in successive numbered statements of the narrative. This idea of writing, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, again, is very conventional as opposed to paragraphs. Even though, you know, paragraph may sort of read nicer in some sense, the idea of having a numbered continuity, numbered statement gives you this idea of being able to refer to different parts of a use case more readily and so on. Sometimes you have to have time as an actor, because things will happen on the basis of some kind of schedule or repetition that's not directly caused by one of the actors. So we typically have a kind of pseudo-actor where we'll invent something like the calendar. The calendar publishes the schedule or something like that, right? Where you have an actor who essentially is being triggered on the basis of some ongoing time. Okay, well, so far we've talked about how we're writing things as if everything works, the success case, the happy case. What happens when things don't work? Well, there's another one of those silly words in use case land, and it's called the extension. Why failure or exception case isn't good enough is sort of beyond me, but we talk about extensions in use cases conventionally, meaning what do you do when your happy case isn't going to happen? Well, you want to design for that. So you'll write a scenario which branches off from the happy case to the extension or exception case as follows. So here you see a case where we have the ticket machine is trying to read the coin to decide if it's going how much money it wants to add, how much time it wants to add to your parking ticket about to be bought. But in this case, it can't determine what kind of coin it is, so it says return your coin. So now you have a failure case, and it tells at this point to go back to a previous step where the car driver will put a coin in. Yes.
So the way that the part of the right
you can
think of action, the main success action, alternate paths, which were
different
ways to get to the same successful
outcome.
Okay. And exceptions were like when the system breaks down.
Yeah, that's right.
But so this seems like it's grouping exceptions.
Well, if there's more than one main way to do things, often that I think that may be more than one use case. I mean, again, it's a level of abstraction problem, but I guess you could have one use case with a number of alternative success ways to do it, and then you have the exception or failure case. Or you could have just, here's the level where you have each of them as separate cases. Again, I guess that's probably going to be depending on your particular situation, I think. Although, I'd probably prefer all of them together. So that would be, because then you say, these are all the ways to get something done, and it would not assume a particular implementation. Because they might differ on implementation.
Yeah, we focus on the goal.
Yeah, again, you want to focus on what you're trying to accomplish, and at all times hide any assumptions about the way it should be done technologically. That's the real problem with use cases. People often write. And it's actually hard to do that. Well, if you're looking at an existing situation and trying to describe it, it's natural to describe what you see, what you observe. And you have to somehow look beyond that and raise the level of abstraction to see what goals are trying to be achieved. And that's why your ethnography is critical. You actually have to get confirmation of what the goals are, not just what the rituals are. Because the rituals could be very much tied to the technology of the situation. Okay. Talked a bit about this, about the idea of including inclusions or subflows, and again, this is very standard, it's sort of how you reuse pieces. I showed you the convention of underlining the included case. Again, I guess the conventional wisdom here is to be careful not to do that too deeply. If you have too many levels of embedded use cases, you basically are intentionally putting a lot of constraints on the implementation in terms of how it's going to get implemented in terms of a software design. So you don't want to do that. You'd rather have somewhat more abstract behaviors implied in use cases. Again, here you see the example. I think we showed this already. Let's skip that. Now, the idea of a template or a meta model is really important. It's a way to encourage that you write the same things in every use case in terms of the metadata that helps you understand it and organize it and see where it fits in with other use cases. The Oracle paper I ask you to read makes some arguments about different kinds of meta models or templates. I'm going to recommend the kind of middleweight template in their paper that essentially lists this information about each use case, essentially who the actors are, a description of the case, which I've already told you how to name. And again, this idea of pre- and post-conditions, which will give you a good sense of where it plugs in with other cases as you assemble more complex diagrams that show you like the entire behavior of the system. Let's see. Give you some advice about how to refine them. It's almost always better to work from the top down, some with a coarse or abstract notion of the goals of the actors in the system. This shows it kind of over time as you go from summaries to user goals or from strategic scope to system scope. The same picture, if you look at it as a snapshot of the results, would look like what they call the ship, where you have a high level or summary goal at the top of the ship. And you see then lower levels where you have more detail, and there's something that's called the sea level, which is the level at which you should stop being able to see. Because below that, you'll have sub-functions, which if you're not careful, will start showing you too much detail. So there's a level where you want to stop because it's like, I think the way they put it is, at what level would doing one of these make you happy in your job? Right? So if you like counting the number of times you would carry out some function, if the user goal level where that would make sense, things below that are things you might have to do but which are not really going to have a business impact or kind of value creation impact. So you will be able to sort of stratify your analysis of your functionality to distinguish those things which are actually meaningful activities and those which are necessary but are not creating value at the granularity which they're described. Really good example here. Again, I talked about the problem of having a consistent level of abstraction. Whenever you describe a process, you have this problem about what is the, in some sense, because every verb could have a lot of semantic space in it. You want to try to have as much precision as you can by having lots of precise nouns around it to help the verbs have more precision. So this idea between high level or system level or business goals, where you say this is the goals of people running the company or running the operation as a complete service system would be concerned about. Below that you'd have user level goals, which are the things that people do. And again, this sort of somewhat glib way of saying, would you like to have count the number of these things that you did in a day and be rewarded on the number of them? That would be a good way to think about it. Versus those things which are below the sea level, things which are sub-function or technical descriptions, which are things you do but which are not really creating business value. So picture on the next page shows this very nicely. It may be the business level goal to run the bookstore, you know, run the emergency room of the hospital. It may be the user goal use cases, the semantic level cases to say I want to, you know, find customers, I want to create customer orders, I want to basically bill customers. Whereas things like logging into the order management system is something I may have to do, but it's nothing which is going to be creating business value directly at that level of granularity, so it's going to be below the line. Let me show you a couple of simple examples from last semester. I've shown you a number of times Bookland because it was a very nicely documented project. They have use cases from last year. Here are business level cases. You know, the goal of the Bookland bookstore service system is to improve customer satisfaction, okay, and to reduce operating costs. And sub, you know, business goals, we do things like reducing the time to find books, or helping customers get their books more rapidly, or to give them personally relevant discounts. Okay? Again, these are business level goals with one level down of sort of system level cases. Okay? Then the complete scenario for the system level case here, the one where the customer is going to get help finding a book in the store. Here you see the meta model with scope and related goals and the primary actors and the description. The description, you see this here. The customer comes up to the help desk and says, I asked the customer service agent to help me find books. Customer agent looks up the book in the system. The system identifies the location. The service agent takes that location and gives it to the customer. The customer finds the book. So again, you see this sort of repetitive, the links between the various actors, the customer, customer service agent, the system, and so on. Yeah?
So how are you
essentially being scoped? I mean, the scope in some ways almost is a summary of the thing after the fact. So I mean, at the level of a system level case, the scope really is not that useful in some sense. It's really a description of the case as a whole. Let me show you the things that are more important. The key concept I want to get across in the last few minutes here is what's called the semantic interface or the essential use case notion. This is a thing which has been very much pushed by Considine, who's a big player in use cases, in a lot of books in use case design. And the point he makes is that it's really important to have a kind of semantic level or a firewall in your descriptions where you don't go past. You don't contaminate your use cases with information about implementation, either current or potential. That's the role of design to decide that, not you as the requirement specifier. So you want to hide that information to leave options for the designers. So you want to describe things in terms of neutral ways of achieving the goals of the actors. And that means, in fact, looking more abstractly at what you're seeing in front of us. You have to look beyond what you're actually observing or what you actually could imagine and try to give the designer more leeway. So you'll see, he makes a contrast. He's written a paper that's very provocative where he talks about how user-centered design is wrong. We want to use the word usage-centered design. Again, it's somewhat glib, but the point is that user-centered design will focus on what people are doing, and usage will focus on what they're trying to do in a more abstract description of their goal. So usage versus user. Users are doing things. Usage is a goal description. Maybe that's not the right words to have, but it's an important distinction to focus not on what people are doing, what their interactions are, but what their intentions of their interactions are. And that, of course, will make use cases simpler because it'll hide detail. So here is the examples from his paper that I want to use here. This is a use case description of going to a bank teller machine. You look and you'll see that the first statement in the scenario says, the system prompts for the PIN. Well, that may be what's actually happening right now at an automatic teller machine, but written this way, that assumes a certain kind of technology for doing what essentially is user identification. Okay? It could say, you know, walk up to the machine and let it look into your eyeball to look at your retina scan, or run your thumbprint across the front of the machine. Those would be equally possible ways of doing the identification, but they'd have radically different use cases. And that would be like an Aaron's case, which talked about a number of alternative ways to accomplish something. You would be distinguishing between retina scan, PIN, and thumbprint, when in fact what you're really trying to do is say, identify the user that we could do this transaction. So that level is obviously going to be proliferating cases that you don't want to do. You want to have a case which is more abstract than that. So Constantine will rewrite this case much tighter by saying, request the identity, and then my intent of the user is to satisfy the request by identifying myself. That instead of saying the system displays a menu of choices that are touch sensitive, I mean, you may be modeling a voice tree, an IVR system, where you don't have anything to touch, you have something to say. So again, offer the choices is an equally good description of the system's responsibility that would accommodate both the voice description, voice interaction, as well as the thumbprint interaction or the keyboard interaction or the touch panel interaction. So again, you see the more abstract, the more essential way of describing this use case. And that's really important, I think, because a lot of you are, you want to be able to say, here's the interaction, and then of course you would know there's going to be a variety of different ways of interacting with it. Could be mobile, could be voice, could be keyboard, could be whatever. But that's something which you can postpone worrying about. You're trying to design a set of services that make sense for some situation. I've already said this, that having use cases usually means that you're going to have some way to take the functionality and then assign it to different groups or assign different responsibilities or be able to visualize it from the perspective of different actors or different sets of functionality. These are three or four of the most conventional ways. I want to talk a bit about prioritization, which is why we had the Moscow one-page reading. This is a really important thing because, of course, it's the toughest thing to do often is to set expectations. And so you need to be clear when you talk to your stakeholder, when you are selling back the requirements to them, as we talked about last week, is the way to ensure that you understand what they're doing. So you don't want to end blaming the customer when things don't meet their requirements. You need to be able to explain to them, and so you have to be clear about which things you think you're actually going to do. That requires that you should have some way of communicating priorities. That can be done by just debate, kind of qualitative means, where you end up saying, well, these are really important, these are not so important, or it can be done in some projects with very systematic and quantitative and, you know, calculations of return on investment for over some time period of each possible feature in a product. I don't think I showed you any of that stuff, but people do it. It's essential if you have a big project. But one of the more ideological areas here, again, it's one of the conventional wisdom, is that you should always use named value scales when you are trying to, say, partition requirements into different levels or priorities. That's because if you say these priorities are 1, 2, and 3, then you can start debating whether 3 is really important enough or it's sort of important or is it something you should try to do or not. If you say, let's do it, let's not do it, there's no debate about what you agreed on when you're talking to a customer. And so here you see two kinds of scales, high, medium, low, essential, conditional, optional. You know, I happen to like Moscow. It's easy to remember what the four levels are. And I think 4 somehow is slightly better than 3. So that's why I like Moscow. But again, the idea is make some decisions about what things are essential, which means things are never going to get done. And those are the two most important bins to find. Things you're not going to do as are important as the things you're going to do, because you want to have things which you know you don't have to talk about anymore. If it's absolutely essential, it has to get done, there's no debate. If you're not going to do it, there's no debate. So these things in the middle that you can spend a lot of time spinning your wheels on, as I'm sure people who build things for a living like Stephanie know very well. So let's find a way to take our requirements and prioritize them into M, S, C, and W. Must means this is non-negotiable. If we don't do this, our project is a failure. Now, it's really important for this to be a very small set, because it's far better to get all your M's done and some of the S's done than to get not all your M's done because the M was just too big in the first place. Because this is going to be communicated not just to your team, but to your customers as well. If you say, this will be part of release 1, because there are M's, and you fail, then even if you got most of them, they're going to have an expectation that says the product didn't meet their needs. So having a smaller set of M's and having some S that you actually get done in the first release is much better in terms of managing customer expectations. Remember the gap model a few weeks ago. They'll perceive the system as being higher quality and better meeting their needs if you met some of the S's as well as all the M's. Now, for me, I'm going to give you an assignment where I want you to write about the M's and the S's so you can't sort of have a small set of M's and have an easier homework assignment. If I just said write about the M's, you'd have a very small set. That'd be the right way to do it and have only very few requirements to write about. I want you to write about the M's and the S's when you prioritize your requirements. But that's basically it. And again, how to do this is up to you. You can basically play rock, scissors, paper as far as I'm concerned. You just have to come to an agreement in your team to say, what are we going to try to accomplish in our, again, hypothetical design? Say, what would be a reasonable set of things to be aiming for in our first kind of coherent set of functionality in our service system? This is your way of saying what kind of makes sense as a package. It can be very small, but this is what we should be aiming to build in our first release or first whatever. Okay? And that's it. I'm going to show you real quickly just one thing, and I'll jump into our project. So, again, the idea is that the task of requirements is to take, and writing use cases, to take bridge between this kind of fuzzy world of idea generation and then being able to actually sit down and start building and designing stuff. So, ideally, that process will take place in a fairly short period of time, so you can, you know, do lots of energy going into the early stages, the fuzzy part, and then quickly get to the part where you're actually getting stuff done. As you saw in the paper by Tom King, I hope, one of the problems that project often faces is that the requirements process is so cumbersome that people either try to avoid it or they do a bad job of it, and in which case they lose the benefits of having done requirements process. And so Ravenflow is this new piece of software which is trying to make rapid requirements generation possible by doing the things that are the most error-prone and tedious part, namely making sure your requirement specifications are consistent and complete and sort of connecting the dots of complex narrative descriptions. I'm going to show you this real quickly. It's a 3-minute demo. And I was going to have a more comprehensive demo today, but I saw, given that you're still doing anthology for another week, you wouldn't care about it right now, so I'm not going to waste your time with it now. I'm just going to give you a taste of it. And next week, when you start a week of doing requirements, take what you've done and where you systematize everything up to that point, you'll then write some use cases for your most important requirements. Then you want to pick out an expert for your team. One person will be the requirements person, the expert who will actually have responsibility for producing this work. Not that they'll do it, but they'll have the responsibility for sort of producing the artifact. And then next week we'll have a hands-on session with HP to actually help make sure you get on your machines and can use the software. Because he's now an expert. He spent many, many hours on this. He's an expert. Isn't that right, HP? No? You better get good at this then. Okay. So. Well, you can decide. You want to have someone learn it or you want someone who's good at it already. I mean, you can decide. Okay? So, let's look at this 3-minute demo and you'll sort of get the idea here.
You are about to see how business analysts can produce high-quality requirements faster. Subject matter experts can review requirements faster. And engineers can create QA test cases directly from validated requirements.
If you've done use case, you'll love this thing. You'll love it.
By using Raven, the requirements operate in a validation environment from Ravenflow. Use Raven to write your requirements in freeform English, and then click the model button to instantly generate 3 different diagrammatic views of the text. The Raven diagrams are always in sync with the text. The diagrams help your stakeholders to review and understand the requirements faster. Raven highlights potential problems in red, such as this incomplete decision point. Embellish your requirements by adding more sections to your text, such as preconditions and business rules. You can also attach screenshots and other illustrations to the diagrams. You can then generate a fully formatted, formal specification document at the touch of a button. Raven compresses days of work into minutes. Get stakeholders sign-off faster than ever before by sending them a link to review the requirements on the Raven collaboration portal. The stakeholders don't need any special training or software. They just use a web browser to log into the collaboration portal, where they can review the requirements text and diagrams. They can enter comments for general feedback and submit issues that require attention. The formal specification document is also available for review on the web portal. The collaboration portal also features an executive dashboard that highlights project risk at the earliest stage of a project. This enables project managers to take corrective action faster based on requirements churn and review timeliness. When the requirements are ready to hand over to development, Raven offers a direct export to industry-leading applications for requirements management and testing, such as IBM's Requisite Pro and HP's Quality Center. You've just seen how Raven shortens the time it takes to write and validate requirements. It helps reduce rework costs by identifying potential problems and shortens test cycles through automatic creation of test cases. The result is overall shorter project timelines and faster time to market. To learn more about Raven,
talk to HP. All right. So again, we right now have an unlimited use for all of us for the individual version run on my PC or someplace. We could use the collaboration if you're interested in that. That requires more work and more setup. So they're willing to let us do that. I think we could have sort of a project requirement space. But that may be more overhead and more learning curve that we want to worry about. So I'd recommend you say, who in your team wants to be the Raven person? These gentlemen who've done this before, like learning tools, but someone who's never done that before, they can learn something about requirements and use cases and so on. Again, as you saw there, the magic, of course, says, write this paragraph of your scenario and push the button and generate it. Right? Of course, the first time you write that, you're going to follow the red box where it says, I'm going to do this activist, it's the same as this one, there's no logic here. Remember the thing we did in class with otherwise and if and then and broken logic and stuff? That'll find all that. But again, depending on how far you got the first time you wrote it, when you type it in, you may have a lot of errors in it. So again, it's not, obviously there's no free lunch. You have to think about stuff a little bit, right? But this will help the refinement of the requirements immensely, as you found last year. And that was a great picture, so sure, he's drawn all the things by hand. And you didn't use to say, what are all the cases that this act is in? What are all the cases that, what's the flow of control of the entire set of use cases and so on? So, today, I want you to think about who would be the requirement, not besides it, but that person will have to get involved, and HP will do a section, make sure everybody gets plugged in next week and so on. Okay? But that's basically it. Now, I'll say one more thing, and then we'll give you some time to work on your project, and that is, give you a taste of where we're going next time. Next time we have one of those crazy mashup lectures where I'm going to try to cover the same thing from two radically different perspectives. Now, so how many of you have used personas before? Done personas? Some of you have. Okay. So personas are a very powerful technique in user-centered design to create kind of hypothetical or representative users and use them as a way to sharpen your thinking about design decisions. It's, again, very commonly used in user-centered design, but not very much used in other places because in similar domains where you have to understand models of users or models of customers, we've gotten very, very quantitative. So I'm having you read some papers about essentially market research ways of understanding what users are about and their preferences and sort of what kinds of features of users or properties of users define classes of customers and users. And you'll see work on customer preference models that we'll talk about as a kind of interesting other universe. Now, together, they're very, very useful. But I suspect that most of you have seen only a little bit of one or the other, but few of you have seen both. It's kind of a nice kind of, new kind of mashup of ideas about what it means to do models of users or actors. Okay? And with that, I guess you'll do your projects. You know, we have, you should be in the middle of an ethnography, or at least be planning it. I'm planning to spend a lot of time in the next 10 days looking over your shoulders. I know that HP and Karen are, and are people feeling the right amount of love from them right now? Too much, too little? No, seriously, you guys, close your ears for a second. Okay. Are you getting the right amount of love from them or too much, too little? Good? People are getting, they're saying, how about this, take a look at this, or here's a picture you should look at, or, right? They're doing that appropriately? Okay. then I won't redirect it, and I'm trying to coach them about how to talk to you all. Much seven listening like that. And again, I will be looking more carefully at all your projects over the next week to 2 weeks, and hope to be giving you much more individualized feedback from me in the next week, based on what shows up on your website for the next week or so. Alright? I'm hoping that all of you will kind of be caught up by next week. We'll have gotten everything sort of figured out about scope, and you'll have done the early ideation kind of activities of the technology review and everything else, and the ethnography will help pull a lot of that together in some way. And then you'll be ready to say, now that we have all this massive stuff, let's sort of prioritize and be more precise about some of the actual functional goals. All right? All right. Go forth and prosper.